Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, as you prepare to pack your kids off to uni, perhaps the best gift that you can give them before they go is some sound financial advice. Well, thankfully, This Is Money are here to help. Also today, could your child be sitting on a £2,000 windfall? We'll tell you how to check. And help to buy. Is it time the scheme got canned? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Now, it's that time of year when parents across the country wipe a tear or crack open the champagne as they pack off their little darlings to university laden with books, dreams and cheese toasty makers. For many youngsters, it's their first step towards financial freedom, a rather daunting prospect, taking control of your spending, bills and budget. Plus, let's not forget navigating the bank stalls at the Freshers' Fair, offering free footballers in exchange for over a decade of servitude to your first credit card. Ignore the footballs, people. So to help parents out, This Is Money have come up with a list of the four essential lessons to teach your children before they fly the nest. So, Simon, your two are a little way off from university just yet, I think, but I'm going to ask you about your own personal experience, because for context, to those who don't regularly listen to the show, I got a little bit caught out on Freshers' Fair, free football in exchange for a credit card. Oh, it took me years to pay off that credit card, and God knows what happened to the football. So, Simon, the best piece of advice you got before you went away to Leeds?
So, I was in a fortunate position when I went away to university. And the fortunate position when I went away to university was that I didn't go straight after school. I went after a year in which I spent 3 months working. I worked for a company that made fans and imported them from Italy and then sold them in industrial fans. And I worked in the office there and also worked in a bar at the same time. And I was then going away to do a season in a ski resort where I was snowboarding, but I was working in a bar. And I then came back and worked for a bit, and then I went to Australia for a couple of months, and then I came back and worked for a bit, and then I went to university.
You kept busy.
So, yeah. So I had experience in terms of A, getting paid money, B, trying to make money last, and C, trying to save money for things.
I took a year out and I learned none of those things.
Right. So what I should say is at the end of that year, I ended up with a load of money on a credit card that I had to ask my dad and mum to lend me some money to help pay off, because made a number of mistakes, and I'll explain what the mistakes were. Now, these will sound like real basics to regular personal finance geeks, listeners, readers, whatever you want to call them. First thing I did, so it's going to take us a while to get to uni here, but I'll tell you a funny story before I even went away. So the first thing I did, I'm working two jobs, right? One of these jobs is at this fan company, right?
Right.
Where I'm getting paid £150 a week.
Okay.
And they paid me by check. The other job was working in a bar where I was working three or four nights a week. So what I decided I would do is I would save the money from working from my day job, and I would use the money from the evening job to live on.
Great. Sounds sensible,
you know,
yeah.
Yep. Earning regular income as someone who's, you know, 18, nearly 19 years old, this was perfect. I had plenty to live on. I was living at my parents' house and so on. Cover my petrol money, going out and everything like that. So what I did in order to save the money was when I got the cheque each week, I would put the cheque in a glass jar in my bedroom. And after about 9 weeks of working there, the guy who was in charge of finance at the fan company came up to me and said, Simon, have we been paying you? And I said, yeah. Well, yeah, you have. It was this Mancunian guy. He was really funny, this guy.
Right.
He's like, right. I was a bit worried about that. And I thought you might be too polite to say something. I said, no, don't worry. I'm not too polite to say if you hadn't been paying me. You've been giving me my paycheck every week. He said, the thing is, it doesn't appear to have been cashed. And I said, no, it's not. And I had to be a bit careful here because I didn't know I was going to leave. I said, well, I've been trying to save some money. And obviously, you know, I'm working this other job in the evenings. So I decided the best way of saving the money was not to be able to spend it. So I haven't been cashing the checks. I've just been putting them in a glass jar. And he said, right. He said, the way the business works is that we have to manage our cash flow. And even though your wages aren't a huge cost, we do need them to be being cashed. And we can't have it that you're building up this sum of money. So if you could cash those checks, it would be absolutely brilliant.
The good news is things have changed somewhat since that point to you being the editor of, you know, the most popular financial...
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and nobody has at any point had to approach me and ask me why I'm not cashing my paychecks.
No, absolutely.
But it gives an example of how you can start to try and save money, but... One way of saving money is just to not have it in the first place and leave it all in pieces of paper in a jar. But another way is to put it into an account, but then you're going to be tempted to spend it. Now, the temptation to spend it is great. So when I did actually cash those checks, once I went away to start my snowball season, I did actually manage to run through that money quite quickly. Mm. Now, whilst I was away, I got paid a very small amount of money. I mean, I genuinely think I was being paid about 30 quid a week or something. Ooh. But I got food, I got board, I got things like that. But what I was doing was I was getting back, paid that money into my English bank account, and then I was spending money on a credit card and taking money out on the credit card and spending it. Now, I didn't know that you shouldn't take money out on a credit card. Mm. So whilst I was taking this money in order to pay off the credit card bills and trying to balance my budget, probably going a bit over, what I was actually doing was running up huge charges for taking out money on a credit card. So when I came back, not only had I been building up this credit card bill, which some of which I've been paying off, some of which I hadn't, I'd incurred a load of charges. Then I did some work. Then I went to Australia. Then I still didn't know about the credit card thing. Spent a load of money on the credit card. So I started off before I went to uni with a few £100s. I had to get a bailout before I even started.
You were lucky it was only a few hundred quid.
But it taught me a valuable lesson.
Yes.
Which was, you need to pay attention to this stuff. And you need to be a bit careful. Now, obviously, like almost all other students, I did run up thousands of pounds worth of debt. The thousands of pounds worth of debt that you will run up consist of your student loan. I had a much better deal on student loans than people get nowadays. Tuition fees were £1,000 when I started, and the interest rate was only RPI. Nowadays, tuition fees are £9,000 and the interest rate is RPI plus 3%. So, and that's a raw deal for people. But the big issue actually for most people's finances is that you get the money and you have to manage it yourself. And so you're getting money either in lump sums or big chunks, that student loan or money that your parents are helping you out with. Then you've also got that whole interest-free overdraft thing, which is really easy to start spending. And it was a common phenomenon that basically almost everyone I knew had a grand or a £2,000 overdraft, and they lived £1,000 or £2,000 into the red, and then when they got money and they went back up to zero, and then they spent their way down. The best thing you can possibly do, I would argue, and what I did, was basically get some kind of job while you're there in order to at least get some money coming in to minimise the damage.
So it's interesting you talk about that interest-free overdraft, because I think, certainly for me, for years afterwards, and I think for a lot of people as well, you're so used to living in it, it feels like it's your money, but it's not. And I suppose the same with credit cards as well.
Well, this is the problem, and I think this is why we wrote this article, and I think this is a real issue, because you might not be going off to university. You might have already been there. You might have already been there, done that, seen this. Your children might not be going, but you might know someone who is. Chances are you know someone who's starting university. And if you're the kind of person who's money savvy enough to be listening to the This Is Money podcast or reading This Is Money, then I would say to you, why not spend 5 or 10 minutes having a chat with that person? As a student, you are thrown in at the deep end. This is probably the first time that for many people they will have had to manage their own budgets, manage their own money, and even if it's not, like in my case, you still manage to stuff it up. And there's just some really simple stuff that people need some help with, because what we do is we start people off in their financial life with a wall of debt that hits them.
Yeah.
And the message around student loans nowadays is, don't worry about the size of the debt, you might never pay it off. And then we wonder how young people manage to get themselves into so much financial trouble while they're at university.
No, you're right. And actually, like you just said there, if you can just have a chat with someone, a young person, you could help them pretty much for the rest of their financial future get onto a right footing. I'm wondering, before we get into the four things that This Is Money came up with specifically, you mentioned there about student loans, and they are huge, and the psychology around it. I can't imagine. It was very different times when I went to university. Are times so different now, given that some of the advice, you know, some parents might think, well, what on earth can I advise kids now? The environment is so different. Or actually, are the fundamentals still pretty much the same?
I think the fundamentals are the same. I think I would argue that the fundamentals of managing your money are exactly the same as when we were at university, as when our parents' generation were at university and were benefiting from student grants and no tuition fees and things like that. I think almost with the student loan system and the tuition fees, you have to take that out of the equation for the conversation. You have to say, look, this is the system that's set up. this is how the government has decided that people should pay for university. There are rights and wrongs involved in that. It would be a real shame for people to not go to university because of it. I could understand why they might make that decision. I'm a critic of it. I think it's wrong to saddle young people with this amount of debt, given the message that they might not, that don't worry about it, you might not pay it back, that it won't affect you, because actually it does affect you in things like mortgage affordability tests and stuff like that. Other people say, well, look, it's just like a graduate tax, and don't worry about it, you might not pay off all the debt, most people won't pay it off, and it's better to have loads of people going to university, and university open to all. So, but that's something. Be that as it may. Put that to one side and say, look, this is how we pay for university in this country, and I don't have 50 grand to give you to pay for university, so you're going to have to borrow that money to do that. But the budgeting stuff, the simple money management stuff, is exactly the same, you know, through the ages. And it boils down to that, you know, a certain amount of money coming in, slightly less than that going out,
exactly.
Great. Certain amount of money coming in, more than that going out, problem. But what I guess you could say to students is, look, you're going to have three terms where you're going to be spending money and you're probably going to end up, be realistic, you're probably going to end up with more going out than you've got coming in. You've got a choice here. You could try and do something about that in the three long holidays that you also get, or you might decide that you want to spend those three long holidays travelling, having fun, or doing some kind of career building exercise. Yeah. But if you're going to be doing the travelling and having fun or career building exercise, you're going to need even more money for that. So think about it.
All right. So what are the four things that you came up with then?
Right. So these are kind of very practical tips that we've tried to go for. Right. I think the stuff around...
Because there are going to be many more than four.
Yeah, there's many more than four. Right. So the first thing is get a decent bank account. So and a decent bank account is not just the one that offers you the best freebies. And I mean, some of them did used to offer some great freebies.
Are you still with your bank account that you signed up to at uni?
No, I'm not.
Oh,
but
I am.
I was for a long time. It was with Barclays, but then I switched in like 2005 or something.
Yeah. I'm not lazy. Mine is actually just okay, right? There's no one else that I'm bothered
about. I switched
about.
Because I tried to phone up the branch one day and I was informed that you could no longer phone the branch. And I said, well, what if I want to ask the branch a question that's specific to the branch? And they said, no, you have to call this central number. So I switched.
Fair enough.
A peak of annoyance.
Yeah, absolutely fair enough.
Yeah. I phoned up, when I moved to Nationwide, I phoned up the Nationwide branch on Kensington High Street. And I said, is that Nationwide on Kensington High Street, which is near our office? They said, yes. And I said, great. So I can call you. And they said, yes, you just did. And I said, right, you haven't got any plans to stop me calling you anytime soon, have you? I can imagine the person on the other end of the phone was thinking, yeah, I've got plans to stop you calling me very soon, mate. She said, no, what are you talking about? I said, well, you're not going to stop people calling the branch. And they said, no. So I
well, I imagine if you try and call up nowadays to any branches, they'll be like, hello, this is a bar or a pub or something. Or
yeah, I bet you can't still call that branch. So anyway, a good bank account. You can get freebies. They try to tempt you with Amazon vouchers, taste cards for discounts on dining out, free rail cards. The free rail card was always very popular. Mm. It used to be things like CDs and cinema tickets and stuff like that. But actually the best thing that you can find is a decent overdraft. So one that's not going to charge you lots of money for being overdrawn, because chances are you might go overdrawn. And particularly one that's not going to charge you big charges if you accidentally go over that overdraft limit, because that's where you can suddenly start picking up really, really big charges. So a couple of the ones that Emma Gunn, our reporter, has picked out. Nationwide and HSBC, that's got a £3,000 overdraft. Do try not to run up the whole £3,000, guys. And Santander also offers a 4-year rail card, which is good.
Can I say that would be my one tip, the rail card. That must have saved me hundreds of pounds, and I used it from the minute you can, 16 to 25, I think it is, to a little bit over when you can.
Yeah.
And it's
great.
Worth it.
Yeah.
It's
I mean, I actually never had one, but then I had a car. So I used to drive up and down the motorway.
I didn't learn to drive till I was 25.
Well, you didn't need to. You had a rail card.
No, exactly.
But so when you choose that bank account, do pay attention to it and do think about, hang on a minute, why am I choosing this one? And maybe actually this is a point to have a conversation with friends and family about, you know, to say, hang on, I'm thinking of this bank account. Do you think this bank's any good kind of thing? There's a lot more information about banks out there nowadays. And the next one is then teach them about setting up a budget. this sounds like real basics. And there's a comment on here from one of our readers going, if you can't run a budget, then you shouldn't be going to university. Fact of the matter is, most people going to university will never have had to run a budget before in their life.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is they need to be sitting down, working out a realistic budget. How much will I spend on food? How much will I spend on going out? How much will I spend on travel? How much will I need to spend on other stuff like books and things like that? Are there any points where your parents might help out? You know, for example, your parents might say, well, I'm more than happy to help you out with your books, but I'm not paying for your vodka nights. And then try and stick to it. And I guess the best way to try and stick to it is to write the whole thing down and do your ins and outs. And we did this after university, but my wife and I were travelling around Australia. We spent quite a long time there. We were working and things like that. We tried to budget. And what we did was we set ourselves a certain amount of money each week. And then we broke it down to how much money we had each day. And then we'd see if we could get under that. And then any extra money that we had under that, we could then treat ourselves with at the end of the week. And if you try and sort of gamify it a little bit.
Sound perfect for each other.
It was basically a way of getting more money for beer. We've got a student budget calculator at This Is Money. And in fact, if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/student, you'll find lots of helpful stuff. But the thing about the budgeting is you need to be realistic. Right. So don't just pretend that you're going to get away with only spending £10 a week on going out if you know that it's going to cost you much more than £10 a week to go out. Don't just pretend that you can get away with spending £5 a week on food because you probably can't. Things like that. And then try and stick to it. And then if you go over it, try and work out what you're going to do to go back under it and try and work out what it is that has made you go over it. This is bad. I mean, I'm a bad person to give this advice because I never did this budgeting thing myself. Did you ever do the budgeting thing?
No, not at all.
No, but I can imagine.
I'm still playing with my free football, Simon.
But you could definitely see how it would have made a difference, can't you?
Oh, huge amount. And also, you've highlighted something there. I jest about you and your wife, but I think surrounding yourself with people that have got your back on this, because one of the things that you probably will overspend on, and it's hard not to do, is you're trying to make new friends, right? You want to buy that round. You know, hang around with people, if you are a bit short, that are happy just to stay in. That sounds really old, doesn't it? Really old and sensible. But surround yourself with good, supportive people, because it really does make a difference.
Yep, that's true, actually. I mean, if you're hanging around with a group of people who really like going out all the time, and the first thing they do is go out, and then they spend the whole evening out until the early hours in the morning, you're going to spend a lot more money than if you're hanging around with people who are happy to stay in and have a few drinks or have some fun before they go out, and then go out for a bit and then come back. And we'll go on to this in a bit, but there's ways of, you know, socialising without going out. And one of those, for example, is another thing we're going to talk about in terms of what you can do is food. Mm. Is why not, like, you know, some of you get together and one night a week, instead of going out, have yourself a little mini dinner party or something like that, where you basically, it's not going to be the most civilised of affairs, trust me. When you hear the word dinner party, that sounds incredibly boring. I'm sure it will end up hugely debauched, but it will probably save you some money compared to going out to the bar.
Do a come dine with me effort. Gamify it, as you said.
Yeah, exactly. You could pretend you're on Love Island or something.
Goodness me. Possibly. I don't know what anybody was like for you.
Okay, but I'm showing myself up as having never watched Love Island here, aren't I? They don't cook their own dinner on Love Island, do they?
You're all sitting there in bikinis going, oh, no, let's not do that. Okay, so what are some of the other things that you've come up with then? So we've got bank account, we've got budgeting.
Number three, this is a way you can help your children out. Check if they need insurance.
Oh, right,
so this sounds pretty dull, but it is actually an issue for people. Most people will find that their parents' contents insurance will cover them at university, but you need to follow certain rules. We had a story on this. Again, thisismoney.co.uk/students, and you will find that. But make sure their stuff's properly protected, because people have got expensive gadgets nowadays, and thieves target students, and thieves target student halls and student flats. And if your son or daughter's prized laptop, mobile phone, expensive camera, any other belongings they've got get stolen, first thing that's going to happen is they're going to be absolutely devastated. Mm. Second thing that's going to happen is they're going to want to replace it, because if it's their laptop, it's essential to their uni work and maybe their ability to watch Netflix and things like that. If it's their phone, it's the way that they communicate with everyone. If it's any other prized possession, then they're going to feel very upset that it's gone. So not only are they going to be upset that it's been stolen, but then they're going to have to replace it, and that's going to be expensive, which is obviously then going to eat into their budget. So There you go. Get insured. Make sure they're properly insured.
I was reading this week that apparently kids now are taking six times more gear than what their parents were taking. And that doesn't surprise me when you think about the amount, like you said there, laptops, smartphones, that sort of thing. I never took that sort of thing. My old brick phone.
People walk around with something worth £600 in their pocket,
yeah,
don't they? You know, in terms of their smartphone. If you've got that and your laptop in a bag, you're basically carrying a grand around with you, aren't you? So it does pay.
Worth thinking about. Yeah.
And if you're using your bicycle to cycle to uni, then that's another 500 quid.
Yeah.
So if someone robs your bag, your phone and your bike, you're 1,500 quid down. So you make sure they're insured, basically. And then finally, help them with budget-friendly recipes. So this is, you spend a lot of money on food, and one of the ways to easily spend a lot of money on food at university is takeaways. Takeaways, I mean, they're the devil's work, aren't they? They're
so
tempting.
I never did takeaways. I was just thinking, no, I had the noodles and cheese toasties.
Really?
I had one in my room in first year, and that was it. I was cheese toasty the whole way through uni.
You know what? Somewhere I've got a checkbook stub, probably, still from university, and in it I've written what all the checks were to, and there was a pizza place called Stanley's that we used to use, and it just says Stanley's £2.80, Stanley's £2.80, Stanley's £2.80.
£2.80,
and the best thing about our flat, our student flat in the first year, was we were on the ground floor, and we didn't have a living room. We just had a kitchen that we used to sit in. But you could phone for pizza, and then you could open the window behind you. And when the pizza guy arrived and rang the buzzer, you could lean out and say, "Down here, mate." And he'd walk down the little grass step and hand you the pizza through the window. So if you sat there at the table with your checkbook in your hand, you could get a pizza from Stanley's for £2.80 and get it delivered to you and eat it without even leaving your chair.
We don't recommend this, by the way.
No.
On many levels, not just financial, Simon.
No, they weren't the world's healthiest pizzas.
No, I imagine not.
They weren't the world's best pizzas either. They were the best pizzas we could find, which is why we were ordering them from there.
And on a hangover, I'm sure they were absolutely delicious.
We weren't hungover by this point. But the point is, it's really easy to spend money on takeaway food. Mm. And it's really easy to spend money on, gosh, we all know walking around the supermarket, it's really easy to spend money on shopping, especially when you're hungry. Worst time to go shopping. So basically teach them some recipes, and you need to teach them a combination of things. Firstly, teach them how to do your home-cooked favourites, okay? These are the things that they like, that they'll miss, that will remind them of home, and also that are familiar, so they'll be willing to try them out. Mm. They're a gateway drug to cooking, basically.
Okay, interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, secondly, teach them a few things to cook that are relatively easy and cheap, but can be shared by them and guests. So say, for example, they decide that there's five of them living in a flat, everybody's going to cook one night, or they decide to do the dinner party that we talked about earlier, stroke, debauch, Love Island evening. They can rustle something up for that. And then finally, you want to track down some easy and quick recipes that they can knock up after a night out to avoid prime takeaway temptation time.
Cheese toasty machine.
Yeah. Oh, sandwich toaster. Yeah.
Right.
I love a sandwich toaster.
Yeah, exactly.
Although a friend of mine, I had a sandwich toaster to go to university. Mm. Mate of mine discovered it. He loved it. We were sat there in the kitchen one night. All of a sudden, there was a huge explosion.
Oh.
He'd shut the lead to the sandwich toaster in the sandwich toaster, and eventually it had melted through it and blown up the sandwich toaster. So there you go. Small piece of advice. If you do get a sandwich toaster, don't cook the lead.
Right.
So basically, if you want some inspiration, get yourself a recipe book, the BBC Good Food website, something like that, and help your kids out. Save some money on some food.
And yellow stickers.
Yellow stickers.
Around supermarkets.
Oh,
I used to do
right.
that.
I thought you were talking about passively aggressively marking your food in the fridge.
Oh, no. No. No, I was never like that. I was never like that. But I did like
my tea bags had the yellow stickers on them.
Oh, I'd forgotten about those sorts of things at university. Thank you for reminding me, Simon. Anything else you would like to add to that apart from my yellow stickers?
No, just tell them to have fun. But, you know, tell them that they're going to have more fun if they don't spend their whole time worrying about money.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, what would really help you and your kids, whatever age, is discovering a hidden cash windfall. Wishful thinking? Well, maybe not, actually, because some £1.2 billion is currently sitting abandoned in savings accounts. Now, this is as a result of a plan by Labour's Tony Blair and Gordon Brown to help children out. Now, around two-thirds of that is taxpayers' money and was given to parents to invest on behalf of their kids. But banks and building societies say that in most cases, families have moved away and they don't have up-to-date contact details to get in touch with them. If they can't be reunited with the cash, well, it'll be wasted. Simon, tell us a little bit more about this. How much money are we talking about here per kid?
So child trust funds were an idea that was launched to help parents save for their children's future. And the idea was that we gave all newborn kids a certain amount of money and then they could save it or invest it. Initially, it offered families a £250 voucher when their child was born and another £250 when they reached the age of seven. Kids from lower income backgrounds were given £1,000 in total. So the idea was you took this money and you either put it into a savings account or you invested it. And there were a number of investment schemes that were set up to help people do it, some of which were better than others, some of which offered more choice than others. And if you didn't do anything with it, there was a default option that just put it into a cash savings scheme. And there was a big thing at the time around a lot of people just not engaging with it, not doing anything with it.
Why? Lack of information? Or
lack of information. Parents are quite busy when their children are born.
Oh, right, yeah.
Inertia. The same reason people don't do things that they're meant to all the time. And then they were just told this has gone into this default account. They went, oh, okay. And it wasn't their money, I suppose. So they were like, oh, well, it's 250 quid from the government. Mm. That's great. But, you know, that's 250 quid that I can't spend. And 250 quid that we can't access, 250 quid for the future that the child can't get for however long. So it takes some of the impetus from dealing with it. A lot of that money people have lost track of. So people will have forgotten. Oh, yeah, do you remember that child trust fund money? So some of it just went into default savings accounts, which won't have been earning great rates, but over the years, it compounds up and they'll have some money. Your kid might have, especially if they got the other 250 when they were seven, they might have 750, £1,000.
Saying a couple of grand here.
So yeah, some of it, were those who invested it could have £2,000 or more. And what the article is about here from our colleagues on Money Mail is trying to encourage people to re-engage with that and track down these CTFs. And if your child had one of these,
right,
if you can remember your child having one of these, and this stopped in about 2010. The final cohort of kids were given 50 quid. When the coalition government came in, austerity measures and so on, they decided to stop this. And
it's just too expensive, right?
Children born between 2010 and January 2011 received only £50 or £100 if they're from a lower income family. So my daughter got 50 quid.
Right.
Which, to be honest, I kind of never really did anything with because it was 50 quid. I should have done something with it because 50 quid is 50 quid. But if your kids were born between September the 1st, 2002, January the 1st, 2011, then they probably got a child trust fund voucher. So try and track it down. If you don't know where it is, try and work out where it is. Well, firstly, you're going to need to go through your old paperwork.
To which I can hear collective groans going, well, if I couldn't be bothered at the start, I can't be bothered now.
Yeah, but if you think about it, it's probably worth more money now. And your child might even be close to the point where they can get at it. So there are about 70 authorised child trust fund providers. A lot of them are working with the Royal Mail to try and trace families who've moved away. But if you don't know where it's held, the easiest way to track it down is to visit the HMRC website. And there is actually a form there. There is one small problem. In order to do this, you have to register for a government gateway account.
Oh, God.
I'm aware that at this point I'm talking to someone who is self-employed and so has a government gateway account. I mean, they are hideous, aren't they?
Yeah.
My wife has just been trying to sign up to the new tax-free childcare scheme because she's self-employed, so she doesn't qualify for childcare vouchers. I mean, it's been unbelievable trying to do it. The government gateway scheme, you also have to sign up to do a tax return or something like that, if you have to do a tax return, even if you're employed. And it is absolutely hideous, isn't it? But do it. Work your way through the madness that is the government gateway scheme, and then the HMRC will tell you where the money's at. And then do something useful with it. Best thing you can probably do, move it to a junior ISA, which replace them. Your child's got a long-term saving horizon. I'd say move it to a good junior ISA provider, low charges, that allows you to invest in lots of different things and invest it into something for them because they've got at least 5 to 10 years worth of investment gains to be made. And hopefully, when they reach that magical age when they can get their hands on it, you will have instilled in them enough money management skills that they don't immediately blow it, but they will also have a nice couple of £1,000 sitting there waiting for them.
Which will really help. And when I said about, oh, people rolling eyes and government gateways and can anyone be bothered with paperwork, that wasn't me being, oh, you know, don't bother. Do, really do bother, because this is money, whether it's 50 quid, Simon, or not.
No.
It's money and it's for your kids. So it's really, that will really help psychologically going to university with a couple of grand in your back pocket. Just like you said, give them some money management tips or point them in the direction of this is money. Now, moving on, we're going to talk about help to buy. So they've gone to university, Simon, and now they want their own property. Yep. So it's the government's flagship scheme to give a leg up to first-time buyers. Now, it's come in for a bit of flack recently. It's due to run to 2021, but could be extended by another 2 years. However, it's being accused of pushing up house prices, benefiting the better off, and leaving some effectively trapped in their own homes. Now, the real winners, some say, it's the house builders. Redrow's founder confirming this view, calling Help to Buy a godsend, just as his building firm prepared to hand him almost £22 million in a dividend bonus. So Simon, remind us then, what exactly is Help to Buy?
Well, if we cast our mind back 5.5 years, 2013, March 2013, budget day. A good day for builders, as I described it at the time. Because a certain Mr. George Osborne, back then, was the Chancellor. And he was under fire. It's easy to forget quite how much fire he was coming under at that point. Austerity was in full swing. Recovery was conspicuous by its absence. And he was getting all kinds of bashing from lots of different angles about how instead of austerity, we should be increasing government spending to help the economy and doing all these things. And he was sticking to his austerity guns. But he had tried pretty much everything to try and get economic growth going. And we were lagging behind the rest of the world. We were lagging behind Europe. We were lagging behind the States. And I think in what was a last-ditch attempt to do this, he rolled the dice on the property market. And he decided that, because the property market is an easy way to revive the economy. Britain's economy is very strongly tied to the property market. We have high house prices, but when people's house prices go up, they feel a bit more confident. But when people move, they spend money on things, consumer goods, their sofas, the washing machines, all the other things like that. And we weren't building enough homes as well. So there's this other concern, we weren't building enough homes. But there was also a worry that houses were too expensive. A worry that has not gone away since. So he came up with this brilliant wheeze that would solve all of these problems. We lend people 20% of the value of a new build property, interest-free, for 5 years, which helps them get a bigger deposit. So it makes buying that property cheaper, gets them over the hurdle of only being able to access 95% mortgage rates, which are more expensive, encourages them to buy more new homes, which encourages builders to build more new homes because they've got people they can sell them to, and they've instantly overcome the problem that the reason why people weren't buying the product they were selling is because it was too expensive. And it's difficult to know exactly how much of the property market revival, which had been flatlining at that point, since the initial bounce back after the financial crisis, it's difficult to know how much of that was down to Help to Buy. Some of it was down to mortgage rates improving. Some of that was down to the introduction of the funding for lending scheme, which bunged banks cheap money in order to lend it to people. But it definitely put a swagger back in the property market step. It definitely gave it that little bump. Maybe it was the little boost it needed to get over the hump. We'll never know.
Yeah, which could have come anyway from somewhere else.
And in a way, Help to Buy worked because it became easier for people to buy homes. More homes got built and the economy did better.
So why the criticism? What's wrong
with
it?
Well, because it was fundamentally flawed. Because if there's a if your problem is that people can't buy something because it's too expensive, lending people 20% of the price interest free only pushes the price up. It doesn't bring the price down. So rather than bringing the price down, we helped push the price up. We gave people free money to buy something. There was no incentive for builders to try and bring the cost of the homes that they were selling to people down. We've seen the big developers' profit margins increased substantially since. They have been making money hand over fist. They have been returning large amounts of that money to their shareholders. I must admit, I have owned shares in house builders for the last few years, and they have been a very good investment, and I've had lots of money back in dividends. Because the thing is, I could see a problem where we needed to build more homes, and the only people who were going to build them were the house builders, and it seemed to be they had a tailwind. It was win-win for them. And also, they've given a lot of money back to some of the people in society who I think really need money. The bosses of house builders. Because it's not easy being the boss of a house builder. You need to have a really big house. You probably need to have quite a few expensive cars. You're probably going to need some really flash holidays. You've got to keep up with the Joneses, because round the corner there's the boss of another house builder, and he might have a bigger house or more cars or a flasher holiday. So, you know, it's...
Well, we're talking about Redrose, the founder there. I mean, he's just one example.
Just one example. There has been a very controversial one surrounding some of the money, some of the bonuses and the share options and the things that have been paid to people. Ultimately, the issue is that 5 years down the line, we've still got Help to Buy. We're still propping up the new build housing market with Help to Buy. And we have now reached a position where there's the obvious suggestion that this is driving up prices. Mm-hmm. There's the suggestion that builders might even be pricing properties. Not only is it driven up prices through the interest-free cash, but they might be pricing properties higher because of Help to Buy.
Yeah.
There's the scenario where people are now having to start paying back those. Like the first cohort are now having to start paying interest on their loans. So all of a sudden their costs are going up. There's lots of those people who didn't quite realised that one of the neat little tricks in this was that when the government lent you the 20%, it was also taking a stake in your home. So if your home went up in value, so did the government's stake. So the government has been profiting from your higher house prices. And lots of those people have bought new homes and then discovered 5 years down the line, 3 years down the line, that their house hasn't actually appreciated by that much in value. They're not necessarily able to pay back that interest-free loan. And if they want to move to another house, they're wondering how they work this one out. And actually, the remortgaging thing is a bit of an issue. But I think the fundamental problem with Help to Buy, it has essentially driven up prices. And I wrote my column about this week. It could have been so different. There was another way of doing this, and all you had to do was do it the other way around.
I want to ask you about that, but I do want to say the only person actually I've known to benefit from this is a banker. So I wonder who this was meant to help, and I imagine it's not the bankers.
There's a lot of ordinary people who have got on the housing market with this. There are a lot of people, ordinary families, young couples.
Wasn't some research saying one in five have been used for sort of second steppers and those more wealthy?
Yes, but just because you already own a home and you're a second stepper doesn't mean that a home is affordable for you, another home is affordable for you. In fact, actually, sometimes it can be even harder to buy your second home than your first home. And the wealthy thing is an interesting one, because that's possibly being taken out of context, because whilst someone earning £50,000 a year, for example, would be considered extremely well off in the northeast, in London, when it comes to buying a house, you're not in the top tier of people who are able to buy a house. So you have to look at all these things in context. And it has helped a huge number of people to buy homes, but it has not dealt with the underlying problem. And in fact, it has made the underlying problem worse, in that houses are now even more unaffordable than they were 5.5 years ago. It's likely that most people who bought under Help to Buy will have seen their house go up a bit in value. But there is the scenario where new build houses are sold as a premium product. So new build houses are sold generally at around 15 to 20% premium to existing housing stock because they're brand new. And so nobody else has lived in it before. The issue is a 3-year-old or 5-year-old new build house, is that still a premium product?
Yeah.
Because it's not brand new anymore, is it? Now, you could argue that it's been freshly built, there should be less problems with it, and so on and so on. But there have been lots of problems with new build homes, and I'm not convinced that the wider world considers newly built or nearly newly built homes to be the best thing to buy. I think they prefer to buy existing homes. And so people are finding that the premium that they paid because the home was new is eroded. And so actually, they might find that even if house prices in the area they live in have gone up, their property hasn't gone up by as much because it's not brand new anymore. And if there's a developer down the road building a brand new one that somebody could buy for a similar price, well, they'll go buy the brand new one if they're going to pay that premium.
All right, Simon, you teased us with what would have been the answer to all of this. So, Chancellor Simon Lambert.
It probably would have been something that George Osborne would have struggled to ride out, I would suggest. But what he should have done is he should have lent the money interest-free to the builders, not the buyers. Mm-hmm. So we should have had help to build, not help to buy. The problem at the time was considered to be that houses were too expensive and that we weren't building enough of them. Now, the way to make houses cheaper and to make sure that we build more of them is to reduce the costs to developers of building those homes. So instead of lending money interest-free for 5 years to buyers, you lend money interest-free for 5 years to builders, which then brings down their cost of building, encourages them to build more homes, and means that they can sell those homes at a lower price to people and still make the same profits. And in fact, you could have even tied the funding to building more homes. So the only way they would have got more, they could have got money, but the only way they could have got more money was to build more homes. This was very similar to how funding for lending worked in terms of banks. The only way they could get more, they could get a certain amount of money, but the only way they could get more was to lend out more money. And just imagine how different things would have looked if we'd spent 5 years making homes cheaper rather than more expensive.
Thank you very much, Simon. Well, we'd love to know your views.
Tweet us at This Is Money. Leave us a comment under the article that we publish each week for the podcast at This Is Money. Or if you really want to, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
And we may even read out some choice ones. Thank you very much, Simon Abbott. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.